For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, learn how the Sister Jose Women's Shelter is helping Tucson's homeless women in ways that other shelters are not. Environmental writer Chris Kokinos explains his view on the hypocrisy footprint that's made by building a backyard pool in Arizona. Teachers' Voices lets an educator explain the idea of Common Core and how it's applied in the classroom. And I'll talk with composer and performer Brad Fidel and find out why he decided to leave Hollywood behind after writing the scores for a series of successful films. Those stories are all next here on Arizona Spotlight. The U.S. Census Bureau lists the poverty rate in Tucson at almost 21%, and a 2012 report on homelessness from the Arizona Department of Economic Security determined that one out of every 100 residents in Pima County has experienced homelessness. Being homeless can be quite different for men and women because fewer resources are available to single women than any other homeless group. Next, Mitchell Riley takes us to a place in Tucson where women are working to close that gap.
The gate to the Sister Jose Women's Shelter is open to women without homes. Sky is one of those women, but homeless is a word she rejects.
I'm just a fellow human being, but I can tell you that when I was younger in Chicago in my 20s, that word didn't exist. It was put on us, and the people I know don't use that word for themselves. We're just people. But there was a phrase in my 20s which was street people, and that to me had more power to it. But the H word, I don't like it. What's the opposite, homeful? You know, you're looking very homeful today.
If homeful was a word, the Sister Jose Women's Shelter might be described that way.
When Jean got this house, she wanted to give us something most of us don't have, which is a really beautiful place. You know, like that's a home. And they've created every kind of service they can think of that women need. There's clothing in the closet. There's places to take naps. In the winter, we sleep over. And they create meals, and people drop off sack lunches. So, you know, to have a place that you could come to, and it's all women, and you can just walk in the door during their open hours. It's the closest thing to a sense of home that I've had in 5 years, so.
Jean Fettigan is the shelter's executive director.
They know their life circumstances, and by and large, they know what they need help with.
She saw women in need while volunteering with a soup patrol on a winter night 4 years ago and knew she had to offer more help.
Sometimes it requires all of us to just listen. We allow them to move at their own pace and develop trust at their own pace. And when they get that, then they begin to tell their story.
Patricia Carrillo is one of the women who frequents the shelter. She lost her job and her apartment. Now she lives out of her car.
I have to have the windows up because of the bugs that come and bite you and, of course, you know, someone coming to bother you. Sometimes I do sleep, but yeah, it's not easy. Yeah, so I wish I had a roof over my head and a bed to sleep on.
Many of the women are fearful during these daytime hours and exhausted by day's end.
Well, I mean, I can't speak for the others that sleep in the parks and the ditches, but, you know, it's scary. You know, like this woman got assaulted not too long ago by two men. Get run off by the police, get tickets, and there's nowhere to go.
Here, the volunteers bustle through the space, preparing food and drink, cleaning the house, and serving the women who arrive each day. There are bathrooms where the women can take 20-minute showers. In August, they counted 62 women and 277 showers. There are two washing machines where they do their laundry and a clothesline in the backyard. an organic vegetable garden, and places to sit and read and watch TV. Fettigan says most of the women come from a place where they've had no one to trust.
It's something that's earned and learned, and you have to have community and a relationship with someone in order to build trust. And that's what we're really attempting to do here.
You okay?
Fettigan, who also serves as the chief nursing officer at University Medical Center, named the shelter after Sister Jose Hobde. Hobde was a Franciscan nun and a self-described missionary at large who spent much of her life serving the poor.
She taught a lot of us about caring for the poor and about giving them dignity and respect. And we all just sort of feel her spirit, her protection, and believe that she cheers us on.
Denise Milne is responsible for the shelter's daily operations. She lives in the house and her bedroom doubles as an office. She's working at her computer.
It's one of the grants I'm applying for. We want to buy some walking shoes for our ladies for the winter. So I'm looking for some comfortable walking shoes that we can ask for.
Homeless women are often overlooked and underserved, she says.
Well, in Tucson, there are more shelters for homeless men than there are for homeless women. And there are men who are able to go from shelter to shelter month by month, year by year, and never end up camping on the street because they have that many resources available to them. These women, the most they'll get usually, if they can get into one of the three other programs other than ours, they'll get about 7 nights a month at the Salvation Army. And if they can't get into another program, they're on the street until they can get back into the Sally a month later. So there's really, you know, not enough beds for homeless women, homeless single women without children.
Milne says Sister Jose is trying to fill a gap. The shelters that do serve homeless women are often only open to them at night, but leave them with nowhere to go when morning comes.
It may be some historical reason of, you know, put jobless people on the street during the day, they'll go get a job. And that's not how it works. They need more support when they're out there during the day.
The shelter has begun its winter schedule with 12 beds available for overnight stays. The home is 1,200 square feet, so their capacity is limited.
We're looking for a larger property. We've moved in, we're very comfortable, but we know that we need more space. And eventually we're going to be looking for employers that will specifically want to hire our ladies.
There was a time when Sky had a home to call her own. Now she imagines how she'd like her home to be.
It means a safe place where I can let my guard down, where there's an interior space and an outside space that I can be myself and not feel threatened or anything invasive going on. But I don't know if I'll ever have that again. I'm not sure.
Jean Fettigan says she wants the shelter to be a place where women can come and get help.
And it's just something that if you're homeless and alone, you don't get to see or feel or be part of. And it's family. And it's people you can learn to trust. That's what it's about.
I'm Mitchell Riley for Arizona Spotlight.
While living in the arid Southwest, an environmental writer should not build a backyard pool, right? Christopher Kokinos is a nature and science writer interested in climate change, geoengineering, and extinction. In 2011, he joined the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona, where he's an associate professor. A recent essay that he wrote for the LA Times caught the eye of producer Amanda LeClaire, who invited Christopher Kokinos to share the logic behind what he calls a hypocrisy footprint.
I call it the swimming pool at the end of time. Roots were chopped, earth scraped, white pipes snaked like the insides of a rocket ship, rebar netted down before the concrete was poured and the tap turned on, filling the pool, which is in my backyard, with water from mountain snowmelt via the Colorado River, the Central Arizona Project, and fossil water from the local aquifer. If there's one thing a nature writer shouldn't do, it's fill a big hole with water in the arid Southwest. When Kathy suggested a pool for our tiny backyard, I hesitated. Even my stepmother, not exactly famous for her environmental views, objected. It would be a waste of the most precious resource in Arizona, akin to installing a snowmaker in Dubai. I considered voicing objections, but Kathy, who for years has missed the lakes of her Wisconsin childhood, really wanted a pool. And once into my first Tucson summer, which featured occasional stealthy swims at the pool of the nearby Arizona Inn, I reconsidered. The heat was astonishing, and the water, well, the water felt good. It helped when I remembered that another nature writer in town had a whopping big pool in her patch of desert. She said something like, "People back east are so critical of pools here, but they're a necessity, like trees in Vermont." Then I found out that a university scientist I work with also has a pool. She told me a few weeks after she met with the Dalai Lama to talk about global warming that when the desert weather gets really toasty, she floats in her pool, looks at the stars, and meditates. Private pools are mostly a new thing under the American sun, part of the post-World War II boom of suburban leisure, though perhaps the oldest known bathing pool dates from Bronze Age Pakistan. People in the desert love pools. They cool off the body and can connect us to a sense of the sacred. The cult of the American backyard pool is, to historian Thomas A.P. Van Leeuwen, somewhat less divinely inspired. He calls it hydrovulgarity. With an estimated 10 million pools in the U.S., this vulgarity is big business, and many of those pools are in the arid West. Another historian, Evan Ward, speaks of modern mirage culture in the American West, consisting of the non-native lawn, golf courses, fountains, artificial lakes, and swimming pools. We bought our Tucson house from a native plants landscape designer, so it's ringed with barrel cactus and desert marigold, no grass. We don't play golf, have no plans for a Las Vegas-style fountain, wouldn't build an artificial lake other than our pool. Ever ready to privately grouse about homeowners with lawns, Kathy and I have given in to one aspect of mirage culture. How soon before we're watching Esther Williams on Netflix? A 2007 Arizona Republic article puts the water cost of a pool in perspective. It notes that, because of evaporation losses, a pool in the desert has to be virtually refilled every year, wasting enough potable water to supply an average house for a month or more. And that doesn't touch the electrical and chemical cost of filtration, or the carbon footprint of building the thing in the first place. We talk of wind farms and bioregionalism, smart grids and phenology, sulfur aerosols and extreme weather, microbes per acre, and yes, carbon footprints. Let's talk about hypocrisy footprint. What would that look like? Would it look like a hole in the ground with pumps and electrical lines and tubes, like a liberal politician with two homes across one continent, a global warming activist who racks up frequent flyer miles like a touring rock star? Humans are almost infinitely flexible in how we adapt and justify. It's one of the things that makes us so capable of dealing with changing circumstance. Without these traits, our species would be long gone. It also means we indulge in hypocrisy. Thing is, we who try to do right by the world often do wrong by it. Inconsciously so, we juggle the personal calculus, carbon footprint on this side of the column, hypocrisy footprint on the other, and we make the choices we do, choices we often cannot defend. Guilt is a fine force for altering behavior, but only to a point. Doing your best means having done worse. The swimming pool in my yard will be a catalyst for some local eco-volunteering and maybe for a household gray water system. But Tucson wastewater helps recharge the city's Santa Cruz River. Would it help if I flush less? We don't much already. Should I up my offsets? I ride my bike to work now. Am I justified? What would nature writer Wendell Berry say? Maybe I'll invite my literary friends over for a swim and see what they think. We'll talk about the end of the world, of the Holocene, drink bottles of organic Pinot Noir, laugh, and in conclusion, get up the next morning and do whatever it is we think we ought, or whatever it is, in fact, that we do.
That was author Christopher Kokinos, an associate professor in the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona. In association with Tucson Values Teachers, Arizona Public Media presents Teachers' Voices. In the last year, the name Common Core has become part of the vocabulary of education nationwide. Arizona has now adopted the Common Core Teaching Standards, which are more rigorous and require students to become critical thinkers. Next, educator Dr. Scott Whitlock will explain how this change in curriculum is being felt in the classroom.
So at Presidio, we moved completely over to the Common Core this last school year, and it's been an amazing experience. One of the reasons I came to Presidio is because you can go to the suburbs and you can find great teachers, and you can go to, you know, a prep school and you can find great teachers. But for some reason, the inner city schools do not attract as many just outstanding, highly qualified teachers as those other places. The Common Core is a nationwide initiative, multi-state nationwide initiative, that really shifts the focus in teaching from teaching knowledge in a vacuum to teaching how knowledges are interrelated with each other. What that forces us to do as teachers is to allow our students to be more independent thinkers, so that they take facts that we teach them. So we don't leave the old way behind completely. We still teach facts. But what we do as teachers are we put a larger emphasis on how students use those facts, the meaning they derive from those facts, and also just how they're going to use those facts later in their life to become responsible, you know, and great world citizens. So that's the Common Core in a nutshell. One of the things we've noticed in incorporating the Common Core is students who, you know, before when we would ask students to write in science or to write in math, that they would be like, you know, Miss Rogers or Dr. Whitlock, this is a math class. This is not an English class. Or Dr. Whitlock, you know, all of this writing and science, what does writing have to do, or what does science have to do with English, et cetera? What the Common Core has allowed us to do, and what we've seen in our students most of all, is suddenly they're starting to put disciplines together. They're starting to think, and this is a very important skill in college in my experience, they're starting to think interdisciplinarily. You know, so they cross disciplines. They see that creativity is alive and well in science, and sometimes the best way to explore something is to write about it. Also with math, writing about math, sometimes math is very abstract and nebulous, and by incorporating writing in a math class out of its element per se, or its traditional element, what you actually get is a kid who's never really gotten the concepts because they've been so numerical. Suddenly this kid who's very good with verbal, you know, expression, suddenly starts to understand number logic and number expressions. So that's been a really huge impact on their lives. One of the things I teach in environmental science is obviously a very controversial topic like global warming. And one of the things the students get most excited and also most anxious about is that we don't know everything about global warming. You know, we have a lot of ideas and we have a lot of evidence, but they're going to have to write that narrative as they mature with this huge pressing environmental problem. So one of the ways that I unlock that is we do climate research on our own, and we try to develop critical minds around science. I love teaching science more than perhaps that I love science, because I struggled so much in my childhood with science, and it gives me an entree into how my students feel when I make them, you know, balance equations or learn the ins and outs of the Krebs cycle and all of these esoteric words that scare so many people away from science. So in a way, I love science so much and I love teaching science so much is because, one, it's the language of the 21st century, first and foremost, and those who know science have a very good shot of doing very well in this world. And second of all, I'm there to tell my students that you can learn this, even if you struggle with it. It's hard, and I'm not apologizing for it, but you can learn it with a little hard work. I want them to know that everything is possible. I never want one of my kids to think I can't do that because I don't have enough education or someone didn't believe in me. So my number one goal as a teacher is to have them be anything that they put their mind to.
That was Dr. Scott Whitlock, a science teacher and the head of curriculum and instruction at Presidio Schools. Many artists dream of moving to Hollywood to work in the film industry, driven by the hope of being involved with at least one successful picture. My next guest had the fortune to be involved with several. Composer Brad Fidel continued his lifelong love for music by writing award-winning scores for movies like Nowhere to Hide, The Accused, and the groundbreaking electronic score for director James Cameron's first two Terminator films. In Fidel's case, as his success as a film composer grew, it made him feel like he was getting farther from his dreams instead of closer. Putting his movie career on hold, Fidel created a one-man show called Borrowed Time to share his story and his music with a live audience. The Invisible Theater is bringing Brad Fidel to Tucson this Sunday for a performance, so I contacted him at his home in California. We were joined by Brad's wife and the director of Borrowed Time, Ann Dusenberry. She's a stage, television, and film actress with Tucson roots.
Hi, I'm Brad Fidel.
And when people say, Brad, what do you do for a living? How do you answer that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. And this is part of our show, Borrowed Time, really deals with this core issue, because my identity from just before the mid-70s, I would have said I was the former keyboard player for Hall & Oates. And then we got to 75 and later, I am a film composer, which in Hollywood means film and television, really. And I am not a film composer anymore. I'm a composer and a playwright and a
surfer
and various other things. But the play, the show, this one-man musical, does deal with that question, you know, having left Hollywood behind, what is my identity? And the difficulty of leaving that seductive world with my name on the big screen behind to become something I didn't quite know where I would end up. I'm ending up back where I started when I was a kid, which was getting out there and performing live for people and singing songs about what I see in the world and inside my heart and all that kind of stuff. And doing that live is quite a privilege.
Well, Anne, let me ask you, since you're an actress, was it because of the business that you met Brad?
Yeah. He came to see me in a play in Los Angeles. So he sat in the audience for an hour or two, taking me in and deciding I wasn't his type based on the character I was playing. It turned out we were fit for each other quite, but it was, yeah, through the theater that we met.
And how is it that you first came to work together creatively?
Oh, how did that start? It was 2.5 years ago, I'm going to say, and Brad began working on this piece on his own. It turned into what it's become in its genesis, a one-man show, and asked me if I would help him co-write or develop it, help produce and direct it, and gradually we began working together through the ups and downs of that sort of partnership and living together and being partners in life together.
This is a bit of a jump, but I was, you know, the part that was really new to me was performing the parts of the show. I'd say it's about 50-50, you know, singing and playing, which has been my world, though I hadn't performed live in over 35 years. But the acting part, there is narration. I do play characters, including myself at various ages and people that I run into. And I really, though I acted a little bit as a kid, you know, not professionally ever, I felt that really I needed some help with that. And I was down in L.A. taking an improv course with a woman who's named Ann Randolph, who's very well known for doing one-person shows and playing characters. So I went down and worked with one of the best. And when she asked me, who's going to direct your show? I said, well, my wife is directing my show. And she did a slow take and looked at me like, you must be out of your mind.
Well, I wonder from Anne, is Brad good at taking notes?
Oh, there you are. Well, not in the original days, no. It was his show. He knew who he was at any given moment, and he knew what he wanted to portray and get across as a message and what his themes were. And he hadn't acted as I don't know, anything but a kid in his life. So it was trying to be in that creative, theatrical brain of mine and give him suggestions and direction we bumped heads a lot.
So, Mark, you know, it's really interesting because it's really blossomed, and now I think I'm much better at it. But what it really required for me to open myself, because I did feel like it was mine and my story, and how can you tell me how I would be in a given scene? I lived it. When I saw a video of our premiere, of our, you know, we called it a premiere, but it was really just a, you know, still a work in progress. I really feel the show is the show now, so Tucson's getting what I think is the true premiere. But anyway, when I sat quietly and watched the video of my performance, I really got it. I got that there was this leap between what I felt I was doing and what the audience was receiving, and that's where Anne's expertise has helped so much in bringing those two disparate things together, so that what I really want the audience to get, she's given me the theatrical vocabulary and helped me develop some of the chops necessary to really deliver what was in my heart.
Did you grow up here, Anne, in Tucson?
I did. I left to complete college. I started at 2 years at the U of A and transferred to Occidental College in L.A. in order to get closer to Hollywood for myself.
Well, when you come back, what do you think about how much it's changed?
I look to the desert and the skies more than anything. I'm surprised by the outstretching land being covered with new buildings. That always surprises me. I mean, the places that I used to ride a horse or drive to be in nature are not so much nature anymore. And that's always a surprise, but that's true everywhere. I'm glad I grew up there when it was small. I'm glad I got to know it as a smaller town, that's for sure. But I love the desert.
Composer and performer Brad Fidel and director Anne Dusenberry present Borrowed Time, A Musical Journey, for one show at the Berger Performing Arts Center on Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. We have a link for more information about the Invisible Theater online at azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. The show originates from the AZPM radio studios. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. Funding for Teachers' Voices is provided in part by Cox Communications and the University of Arizona College of Education. I'm your producer and host, Mark McLemore.